Accession number 17564, Reel 2.
John's Reel 2.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I was standing there by myself, looking round at everybody, milling around, some standing still, just gaping, and I spotted this tall Canadian gunner standing by himself. So I went over and said, have you got any crew yet? And he said, no. So I said, right, that's it. Let's see who we can find. So we found a pilot who hadn't been fixed up with anybody. So that's three of us. Now all we had to find was a bomb aimer and a gunner, which we did. And they were all Canadians. I was the only English one in the crew. It was a mixture of English and Canadian. We didn't realise at the time, though, that we were going to be posted to a Canadian squadron. But this was just the method of getting a crew together. It was general practice. This was the way they did it. They didn't order you to go with so-and-so or you go with him. You picked your own bods that you liked the look of. And that's the way a crew was formed. At this time, all they wanted was five for a crew of a Wellington, which was the aircraft that we were flying at OTU. Now, this was crew training. The pilot didn't need any training. The pilot we picked, we found, was an ex-instructor. He'd been instructing in Canada, so we reckon we got a good pilot. And then we had to go work together as a crew, cross-country flights during the day, night flying. I'd be practicing getting fixes and bearings. And that the bomber would be practicing doing a run up on beacons, radio beacons, for bombing practice. It was really getting yourself together as a crew, learning about the aircraft that you're flying, and that. And then at the end of that period, certain crews were selected to go on the first op, which was usually an easy one, northern France or Belgium, somewhere like that, and drop leaflets. We called it dropping toilet paper. But that's what we did. We went, at the end of the course, we went to Orléans in France, a leaflet raid. And we came back with a few holes in the fuselage.
This is a Wellington?
The Wellington 1C.
Do you remember how the holes happened?
Well, there was a bit of flak getting a bit close to us. But we had a good pilot.
Where did you fly from for that operation?
From Atherstone, a satellite station at Pershore.
So this was in the summer of 43?
Yeah.
How did you feel on this first operational flight?
Oh, a bit nervous.
Do you remember the name of the pilot?
Oh, yes. Flying Officer Rogers, Len Rogers. He'll come up, his name's going to come up again.
Did you find the Canadians much different from the British?
Oh, not a great deal, but first thing I realised, there was no class structure at all. They were like Australians and South Africans, New Zealanders. They all spoke the same. There was no upper class, middle class, lower class, nothing like that. They were all the same. And we got on very well with them. Very well indeed. They were more easygoing, I should think. I don't mean, by that saying that, I don't mean there was a lack of discipline. The discipline was there just the same, but a little more free and easy about it. There were certain things they'd draw the line at. I mean, you couldn't go, as a sergeant, you couldn't go in the officer's mess, and officers couldn't go in the sergeant's mess unless there was some special do on. That was the only division, really, between them.
And then the next stage, I think, was this heavy conversion to Halifax's.
Yeah, that was that really concerned the pilot more than the rest of us, because he was converting from two engines to four, which was a big jump, really. For us, it didn't make much change, except the fact that we had a flight engineer now and another gunner. So that made up the crew of seven. The flight engineer, of course, was fully trained. But again, it was a case of training as a crew together, getting to know each other.
Was being on the inside of a Halifax much different from being on the inside of a Wellington?
Oh, yeah, it was a bigger aircraft altogether. I mean, you did, in a Wellington, walking down the fuselage, you had to stoop a bit, but in a Halifax, you could almost stand erect, unless you were very tall. And the Wellington, of course, was fabric covered, and walking down the fuselage of a Wellington, there was only a narrow, very narrow wooden walkway. I mean, in the dark, if you stumbled, you missed the wooden walkway, you could put your foot through the canvas out into the fresh air. You couldn't fall out the aircraft. I mean, the holes between the geodetics weren't that big enough to fall out, but you could put your foot out through it, and the ground staff would be very annoyed when you got back. With a big gaping hole in the fuselage.
Did it actually happen to you?
No.
And then? What happened next? Did you go on to an operational squadron?
Conversion unit, yes. We were posted to Middleton St. George, to 428 Squadron.
Where's Middleton St. George?
That's about halfway between Darlington and Stockton.
What were the facilities at Middleton St. George?
Well, it was an operational station, and it was like a small town, self-supporting in every way. Very closely guarded, of course. I mean, you couldn't just walk in and out. We arrived, I can give you the exact date in the logbook. And almost the day we arrived there, Len Rogers, our pilot, was told that he'd be flying that night on a second dickey. That means a second pilot to gain operational experience, find out what it's like over the target and things like that. And he was to fly with Sergeant Chappell. He took off. We saw them all take off, and the plane with Len Rogers in it was shot down into the North Sea on the way home. So that left us without a pilot. So we had to go back to Croft, the conversion unit, to start all over again there with a new pilot. And again, the pilot we got was one that had a lot of experience, because he'd already done a tour. In fact, I'd flown with him at Atherston as in training as an instructor. So we knew him already. So we got through that course again at Croft, and then went back to Middleton St. George to start operations. Can I just...
I think the operation started 15th of September 1943.
Yeah.
And you've put Montluçon in France.
Yeah.
Do you remember those operations that you started with Halifax's?
Yes, oh yes. It was a rubber factory we were after. And really did set it on fire. So I do remember that one.
Can you take me through what would happen to you personally on a raid? Can you take me through step by step on a typical raid as far as you were concerned?
Well, there'd be the usual pre-flight checks, checking all the equipment, but as a wireless operator, I was responsible for other things apart from the radio. I mean, I had to make sure that the intercom was working, also the emergency intercom, which was a system of lights that they could flash by pressing a button if the intercom had gone off for some reason or other. And then I had I was responsible for the engine-driven generators. Not that I could do much about them if anything happened to them, but I had to check the whether they were charging up or not. I was responsible for the photo flashes, flares, sea markers, Vidi pistol, and the cartridges. What else? And later on, dropping window, which was the silver strips.
How was that dropped?
That was dropped in small packages. Well, it was loaded into the aircraft in bales, about a foot square. And when that was opened, it found the tinsel was in bundles about 6 inches square, which would, 4 or 5 inches square, and about 10 inches long, which would just go down the flare chute. And there was a paper band round them. And, of course, when they hit the slipstream, they would burst open, and then everybody doing this, there's silver strips coming down like snow. So I was really responsible for quite a lot of things apart from in addition to the radio equipment. Oh, the skipper's radio, I had to check that in the morning. That was his RT radio for ground to aircraft. So most of the time I'd be listening to group, okay, for group broadcast, which was always in code, of course. And there usually be winds, you know, or alteration to winds, which I would pass to the navigator. And then later on they brought out a thing called tinseling, which was giving the radio operators a certain frequency to cover on the receiver. And if you picked up anything that you felt was a ground control to a fighter, you back-tuned your transmitter to the frequency and then put a switch over which brought in a microphone inside one of the engine nacelles and pressed the Morse key. Every time this fellow on the ground opened his mouth, you pressed the Morse key and all he got was the sound of a Rolls-Royce Merlin in his headphones. So you jammed him out. But you had to be sure, you know, that you know, you got the frequency right. Your transmitter was bang on the frequency of what you were hearing. It did work, apparently.
What was it called?
That was called tinseling.
And it was a form of jamming?
Yes, yeah. And then later on there was part of the H2S, which was called Fish Pond, which was a little screen that I had by the side of the table, which covered the tail of the aircraft, and they were supposed to pick up a fighter that could be coming in from astern. So between all other things, I had to watch that.
How efficient was Fish Pond?
I didn't really have a lot of experience with it. I can't say I ever picked anything up, but I might have picked something up when we were attacked, because I was listening to a group broadcast at the time, and I was writing in my log. I wasn't watching the fish pond, so it that could have been the time that I could have picked something up on it. Then again, people used to say that it emitted a signal and your aircraft could home in on it. So it might have a downside to it.
I noticed that in your logbook it sometimes says next to operations DCO. What does that stand for?
Duty carried out.
Which of the operations you did stick out particularly in your mind, apart from the one where you came down?
possibly Leipzig.
Why does that stick out in your mind?
Well, they'd planned it very well. They'd given us a route that was taking us directly to Berlin. And just short of Berlin, we were to turn south and go on to Leipzig. And the pathfinders were to drop marker flares on Berlin and to do everything to create the impression that the main force were going to Berlin. But of course, what happened, we turned south short of Berlin and went on to Leipzig. Well, that would give us a bit of breathing space because the fighters would have to go down and refuel. And by the time they got back up again, we'd be on our way to Leipzig. Unfortunately, it didn't work out like that because the Met forecasts were all wrong. And everybody was going to arrive at this turning point far too early. So he had to waste time, throttle back, weave a bit, dogleg. Everybody was, I think it was about 10 minutes. And by the time we got to the turning point, the Germans realised that Berlin wasn't going to be the target. So they were more or less waiting for us down at Leipzig. And they lost quite a bit that night. If you want any more information about this, I've got the Bomber Command War Diaries, which could, fill in any gaps.
We'll just stick to your personal memories.
All right.
Did you see any aircraft come down that night?
Yeah.
What did it look like?
Well, of course, I didn't spend much time looking out the window, really, because I was so busy, but I've seen aircraft blow up. It's a terrible sight, really, because you can't mistake it to be an aircraft blowing up because all the bits are falling down, blazing. You realise there's 7 men gone.
When something like this happened, did the air crews tend to blame anybody for it?
No, I can't remember anybody. Well, the navigator would get a bit annoyed about the wind business when winds weren't as forecast. I mean, it was nobody's fault if the wind dropped or changed, you know. I mean, we just had to do the best we could with it. Later on, they used to send mosquitoes over to find out what the weather was like, and they'd usually get back before we took off. Spitfires could do northern Germany, you know, and have a look at the weather and come back and report. But the winds were very there's just no way of forecasting it over there. You can tell what we were going to get, but not what it was going to be like over there.
From your logbook, it says the Leipzig raid was 19th of February 1944.
Yeah.
Any other raids that particularly stick out in your mind?
Well, the other 4 I did on Berlin were pretty grim. I mean, in terms of searchlights, and sometimes the fighters would lay flares on your track, the way you were going in. They found out your track into the target, and they would lay flares, route markers, which lit the sky up, you know, it was almost like day. And another thing that used to worry us a bit was 10-tenths cloud with clusters of searchlights shining on the base of the cloud, which meant that light would filter through the cloud and You'd see aircraft silhouetted against them, against the cloud. They were very fond of doing that.
Why was Berlin so grim, as far as you were concerned?
Flak, mainly. I mean, it was the most heavily defended place in Germany. Flak and searchlights. Plus fighters, of course.
So it wasn't particularly the length of time it took to get there?
No. No, you might be droning across Germany, you know, for about 10 minutes or so, nothing happening, you know, absolutely nothing.
So did it affect morale when you learned that you were going to Berlin?
Oh, there was a groan. I mean, you go in the briefing room and at the end of the room would be a big board with a map of Europe on it, North Europe, which was covered by a curtain. And then, of course, when everybody had settled and the door was shut and guarded, the curtains would be pulled aside and you'd see right away where that red line went to. And there'd be a groan, oh, God, not there, you know. Oh, no, and they'd say, sorry, fellas, it's the big city again.
Usually referred to it as the big city.
The big city, yeah.
Was there any particular place which you preferred to go to?
Oh, no, I didn't prefer to go to any of them. Northern France wasn't so bad later on when we were doing the railway targets. I mean, they weren't too bad. Well, in fact, they were considered milk runs, and at one point they deliberated whether to count it as a complete op, give us half an operation for it. So it means you had to do two to get one. But they scrubbed around that idea later on because you could get shot down, as I proved.
Did you ever come across aircrew with low morale who had to be pulled out?
No. I know my rear gunner was... he was getting near the limit, I think. I mean, he used to have some dreadful nightmares. We shared a billet. I've been woken up in the night with him, tearing at his pyjamas like that, searching for a ripcord. I know it was getting to him, but you never let us down. You didn't let your crew down.
So you were in the same quarters as he was?
Yeah.
Mm. Just the two of you?
Yeah. Oh, no, there were other people. It was an Essen hut at the time, because the sergeant's mess was full, and the overflow went into Nissen huts. There was about eight of us in the Nissen hut. But later on, as casualties occurred, the room in the sergeant's mess became vacant, and I managed to move in. There were two of us in a room.
Do you ever get any VIP visits to your station?
No, I don't recall any. No. The king came shortly after I was shot down. He dished out some gongs, but I was away then.
Which group were you in?
Sixth group. Oh, getting back to this LMF business, you know what that means, don't you?
Lack of moral fibre.
Yeah. I can't recall anybody going off operations at all for any excuse. Maybe they did and I didn't know. But there were two squadrons on the station, you know, it could have happened on the other squadron. Because we didn't, apart from in the mess, we didn't mix much. Because we had our own flight offices and that. But I can't remember. Nobody wanted to do that. I mean, that was the last thing you wanted. I mean, you were let go in LMF, you were letting yourself down, you were letting your crew down. Excuse me, you were letting the whole Air Force down, weren't you? I mean, unless you were really mentally ill. But they didn't encourage people to go sort of mentally sick. didn't encourage that at all. They didn't want them all coming out. So anybody who did go LMF was dealt with very harshly. They were stripped of all rank and put on general duties and given the lowest jobs, cleaning toilets out and things like that, you know.
Coming back to the operations, do any others that stick out in your mind?
There was one. We went to, where was it? I could find the target, but what matters really is coming back. We got off track again, probably through winds, and we found ourselves over Amsterdam, which was very heavily defended, and we were combed in searchlights for a long time. Well, it might have only been minutes, but it seemed a long time. And we couldn't get out of them at all. And I'm almost sure the skipper put the thing on its back nearly to get out. Eventually we did get out of them. But I thought our number was up then. He was doing violent evasive action. I'd be lifted out the seat 1 minute and thrown to the floor the next. And what I do remember, he was... pilot was shouting, "Try the IFF." Well, there were six channels on the IFF, which is identification, friend or foe. It's, you don't use it normally, but I tried all the different set positions. The six positions went round through the lot, and eventually the searchlights fell away. And I like to think it was me fiddling about with the IFF. But I think we got out of it really through the skill of the pilot.
And you were coned over where?
Amsterdam. The anti-aircraft fire was getting very close. Thought if we don't get out of this in another minute or so, we've had it.
What about the raids on the Ruhr?
Bochum. We nearly bought it there. We got an 88mm shell through the port wing, which didn't explode. I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if it had. And it severed, either severed a petrol line or damaged a tank. But anyway, the flight engineer did a magnificent job by running all four engines off one tank until it was empty. And then, because we had a cross-flow system, you see, you could run the engines off various tanks by changing the cocks. And he ran all four engines off one tank. Well, you have to excuse me, I must